Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything that we record at vnnforum.com as part of our Learning College, teaching you for the first time a true white context in which to place your life and see what you are, what you mean, what your people mean, and where we're all headed. We've been doing Henry Ford's Unabridged, The International Jew, and now we're going to pick up with chapter, what is it now? Probably 64, I think it is, and it's Angles of Jewish Influence in American Life. Actually, chapter 65, yes. Angles of Jewish Influence in American Life, more general from the, recently we've been talking the late chapters about their influence in money and then in the liquor industry last segment, and this time we're going to do two chapters and just talk more generally and see what Ford has to say. His researchers writing this back in 1921. In the Dearborn Independent. So, Angles of Jewish Influence in American Life. The Jewish question exists wherever Jews appear, says Theodor Herzl, father of Zionism, because they bring it with them. It is not their numbers that create the question, for there is in almost every country a larger number of other aliens than of Jews. It is not their much boasted ability, for it is now coming to be understood that give the Jew an equal start and hold him to the rules of the game, and he is not smarter than anyone else. Indeed, in one great class of Jews, the zeal is quenched when the opportunity for intrigue is removed. The Jewish question is not in the number of Jews who reside here, not in the Americans' jealousy of the Jews' success, certainly not in any objection to the Jews' entirely unobjectionable Mosaic religion. It is in something else. And that something else is the fact that Jewish influence on the life of the country where Jews dwell, in the United States, it is the Jewish influence on American life. That the Jews exert an influence, they themselves loudly proclaim. One is permitted to think that they really claim a stronger influence than they possess, especially in those higher regions where excellent and determinative influences have been at work. The Jews claim, indeed, that the fundamentals of the United States are Jewish and not Christian, and that the entire history of the country should be rewritten to make proper acknowledgement of the prior glory due to Judah. If the question of influence rested entirely on the Jewish claim, there would be no occasion for doubt. They claim it all. But it is kindness to hold them to the facts. It is also more clearly explanatory of conditions in our country. If they insist that they, quote, gave us our Bible, and, quote, gave us our God, and gave us our religion, as they do over and over with nauseating superciliousness throughout all their polemic publications, not a single one of these claims being true, they must not grow impatient and profane while we complete a list of the real influences they have set at work in American life. It is not the Jewish people, but the Jewish idea, italics, and the people only as vehicles of the idea that is the point at issue. As it was Prussianism and not the German people that was the objective in the recent war, World War I, so in this investigation of the Jewish question, it is Jewish influence and the Jewish idea that are being discovered and defined. The Jews are propagandists. This was originally their mission. But they were to propagate the central tenet of their religion. This they failed to do. By failing in this, according to their own scriptures, they failed everywhere. They are now without a mission of blessing. Few of their leaders even claim a spiritual mission. But the mission idea is still with them in a degenerate form. It represents the grossest materialism of the day. It has become a means of sordid acquisition instead of a channel of service. The essence of the Jewish idea in its influence on the labor world is the same as in all other departments, the destruction of real values in favor of fictitious values. The Jewish philosophy of money is not to make money, but to get money. The distinction between the two is fundamental. That explains the Jews being financiers instead of captains of industry, and here Ford is probably what motivated him originally to look into this stuff, as he found that there was a power greater than the management and the labor, and that was setting them at odds, and that was finance, and that was controlled by some private set of people, and he wanted to better understand them. And I think that was one of the, if not the only or the main or the first driver behind his having his staff research this stuff, was certainly a major one. And he would be himself a captain of industry, and he's saying, I'm a captain of industry. I make things. I make cars, honest cars for the American worker, and I pay my workers top dollar. So I'm serving the country, and I'm making money by serving the country. That's good, honest market work, capitalism, whatever you want to call it, but there's something else, and that's fictitious values replacing real values. The creative, constructive type of mind has an affection for the thing it is doing. The non-Jewish worker formerly chose the work he liked best. He did not change his employment easily because there was a bond between him and the kind of work he had chosen. Nothing else was so attractive to him. He would rather draw a little less money and do what he liked to do than a little more and do what irked him. The maker is always thus influenced by his liking. Not so the getter. It doesn't matter what he does, so long as the income is satisfactory. He has no illusions, sentiments, or affections on the side of the work. It is the geld, in quotes, that counts. He has no attachment for the things he makes. He doesn't make it, for he doesn't make any. He deals in the things which other men make and regards them solely on the side of their money-drawing value. The joy of creative labor, in quotes, is nothing to him, not even an intelligible saying. Now, previous to the advent of Jewish socialistic and subversive ideas, the predominant thought in the labor world was to make things and thus make money. There was pride among mechanics. Men who made things were a sturdy, honest race because they dealt with ideas of skill and quality. And their very characters were formed by the satisfaction of having performed useful functions in society. They were the makers, and society was solid as long as they were solid. Men made shoes as exhibitions of their skill. Farmers raised crops for the inherent love of crops, not with reference to far-off money markets. Everywhere the job was the main thing, and the rest was incidental. The only way to break down this strong safeguard of society, a laboring class of sturdy character, was to sow other ideas among it. And the most dangerous of all the ideas sown was that which substituted get for make. With the required manipulation of the money and food markets, enough pressure could be brought to bear on the ultimate consumers to give point to the idea of get, and it was not long before the internal relations of American business were totally upset, with Jews at the head of the banking system, and Jews at the head of both the conservative and radical elements of the labor movement. And, most potent of all, the Jewish idea, capital J, capital I, sowed through the minds of the working men. What idea? The old idea of get, in quotes, instead of, in quotes, make. So, the most dangerous idea Jews sowed was the idea of getting something by any means rather than making it honestly. The idea of get is a vicious, antisocial, destructive idea when held alone. But when held in company with make, and as second in importance, it is legitimate and constructive. As soon as a man or class is inoculated with a strictly Jewish idea of getting, i.e. getting mine, getting while the getting is good, honestly if you can, dishonestly if you must, but get it, all of which are notes of this treasonable philosophy, the very cement of society loses its adhesiveness and begins to crumble. The great myth and fiction of money has been forced into the place of real things, and the second step of the drama can thus be opened up. And the intelligent among you will notice the parallel to the sexual looseness Jews promote. So they promote greediness and promiscuity and the idea of no loyalty, not to your job, not to your employer, not to your worker, not to your wife, just everything for you, be totally selfish all the time and grab it by fair or foul means. That's all that matters. This is what they promote. Jewish influence on the thought of the working men of the United States, as well as on the thought of business and professional men, has been bad, thoroughly bad. This is not manifested in a division between capital and labor, for there are no such separate elements. There is only the executive and operating departments of American business. The real division is between the Jewish idea of get and the Anglo-Saxon idea of make. And at the present time, the Jewish idea has been successful enough to have caused an upset. All over the United States, in many branches of trade, communist colleges are maintained, officered, and taught by Jews. These so-called colleges exist in Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Rochester, Pittsburgh, New York, Philadelphia, and other cities, the whole intent being to put all American labor on a get basis, which must prove the economic damnation of the country. And that, apparently, is the end sought, as in Russia. Until Jews can show that the infiltration of foreign Jews and the Jewish idea into the American labor movement has made for the betterment in character and estate, in a citizenship and economic statesmanship of the American working man, the charge of being an alien, destructive, and treasonable influence will have to stand. The last place the uninstructed observer would look for traces of Jewish influence is in the Christian church, yet if he failed to look there, he will miss much. If the libraries of our theological seminaries were equipped with complete files of Jewish literary effort in the United States during the past 15 years, again before leading up to 1921, and if theological students were required to read these Jewish utterances, there would be less silly talk and fewer easy marks for Jewish propaganda in the American pulpit. For the next 25 years, every theological seminary should support a chair for the study of modern Jewish influence and the protocols. The fiction that the Jews are an Old Testament people faithful to the Mosaic Law would then be exploded, and timid Christians would no longer superstitiously hesitate to speak the truth about them because of that sadly misinterpreted text, "I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee." There is a mission for the pulpit to liberate the church from what the New Testament scriptures call the fear of the Jews, unquote. The pulpit also has the mission of liberating the church from the error that Judah and Israel are synonymous. The reading of the scriptures which confuse the tribe of Judah with Israel, and which interpret every mention of Israel as signifying Jews, is at the root of more than one half the confusion and division traceable in Christian doctrinal statements. The Jews are not the chosen people, though practically the entire church has succumbed to the propaganda which declares them to be so. The Jewish tinge of thought has of late years overspread many Christian statements, and the uninstructed clergy have proved more and more amenable to Jewish suggestion. The flaccid condition of the church, so much deplored by spokesmen who had regard for her inner life, was brought about not by science, not by scholarship, not by the increase of light and learning, for none of these things are antagonistic even to incomplete statements of truth, but by Jewish-German higher criticism. The defenders of the faith have fought long and valiantly against the inroads made by the so-called higher criticism, but were sadly incapacitated in their defense because they did not see that its origin and purpose were Jewish. It was not Christian, it was not German, it was Jewish. It is almost wholly discounted today in the practical life of the church, but it still adheres to the darker corners of the colleges, along with the red Bolshevism which is taking root there under Jewish influences. Let the Christian minister who wishes to know the source of Jewish influence in the church look over the names of the more notorious German higher critics of the Bible and consider their race. Add to them one Frenchman, an atheist, and a Jew, and you have modern liberal sources very complete. He lists them, six of them. Wellhausen, Strauss, Ewald, Kuhne, Hitzig, Renan. It is perfectly in keeping with the Jewish World Program that this destructive influence should be sent out under Jewish auspices, and it is perfectly in keeping with non-Jewish trustfulness to accept the thing without looking at its source. A great many so-called liberals played the Jewish game for a time. They are now coming back to the old citadel, which stood in its own strength and without their patronage while the fever of higher criticism raged. The church is now the victim of a second attack against her. In the rampant socialism and Sovietism that have been thrust upon her in the name of flabby and unmoral theories of brotherhood and in an appeal to her fairness, the church has been made to believe that she is a forum for discussion and not a high place for enunciation. She has been turned from a voice into an echo of jangling cries. Jews have actually invaded, in person and in program, hundreds of American churches with their subversive and impossible social ideals, and at last become so cocksure in their domination of the situation that they were met with the inevitable check. Clergymen ought to know that 7/8 of the economic mush they speak from the pulpit is prepared by Jewish professors of political economy and revolutionary leaders. They should be informed that the economic thought has been so completely Judaized by means of a deliberate and masterly plan of camouflage propaganda that the mass thought of the crowd, which is the thought mostly echoed in popular pulpits and editorials, is more Jewish than Jewry itself holds. The Jew has got hold of the church in doctrine, in liberalism, so-called, and in the feverish and feeble sociological diversions of many pulpits and adult classes. If there is any place where a straight study of the Jewish question should be made, with the Bible always in hand as the authoritative textbook, it is in the modern church, which is unconsciously giving allegiance to a mass of Jewish propaganda. It is not reaction that is counseled here, it is progress along constructive paths, the paths of our forefathers, the Anglo-Saxons, who have to this day been the world builders, the maker of cities and commerce and continents, and not the Jews, who have never been builders or pioneers, who have never peopled the wilderness, but who move in upon the labors of other men. They are not to be blamed for not being builders and pioneers, perhaps. They are to be blamed for claiming all the rights of pioneers. But even then, perhaps, their blame ought to not be so great as the blame that rests upon the sons of Anglo-Saxons for rejecting the straightforward building of their fathers and taking up with the doubtful ideas of Judah. So we see that they've invaded the workplace and their influence has been negative. They've invaded the church and their influence has been negative. Now we're going to hear about them invading the college. Colleges are being constantly invaded by the Jewish idea. The sons of the Anglo-Saxons are being attacked in their very heredity. The sons of the builders, the makers, are being subverted to the philosophy of the destroyers. Young men in the first exhilarating months of intellectual freedom are being seized with promissory doctrines, the source and consequences of which they do not see. There is a natural rebelliousness of youth, which promises progress. There is a natural venturesomeness to play free with ancient faiths, both of which are ebullitions of the spirit and significant of dawning mental virility. It is during the periods when these adolescent expansions are in process that the youth is captured by influences which deliberately lie in wait for him in the colleges. True. In after years, a large portion come to their senses sufficiently to be able, quote, to sit on the fence and see themselves go by, unquote, and they come back to sanity. They find that free love doctrines make exhilarating club topics, but that the family, the old-fashioned loyalty of one man and one woman to each other and their children, is the basis not only of society, but of all personal character and progress. They find that revolution, while a delightful subject for fiery debates and an excellent stimulant to the feelings of superman-likeness, is nevertheless not the process of progress. And two, they come at length to see that the Stars and Stripes and the Free Republic are better than the Red Star and Soviet sordidness. When a Supreme Court justice addressed one of the greater American universities, a student came to him after the lecture and said, "It gave me so much pleasure to hear your lectures, for they were the first kindly words I have heard said about our government since the commencement of my university career." For years, the secular magazines have been carrying articles on the question, "What is wrong with the colleges?" The answer is perfectly clear to those who can discern Jewish influence in American life. The trouble with the colleges has progressed along precisely the same lines that have been described above in connection with the churches. First, Jewish higher criticism and the destruction of young men's sense of respect for ancient foundations. Second, Jewish revolutionary social doctrines. The two always go together. They cannot live apart. They are the fulfillment of the protocols programmed to split non-Jewish society by means of ideas. It is idle to attack the unbelief of college students, idle to attack their radicalism. These are always the qualities of immaturity. But it is not idle to show that social radicalism being a very good word, sadly misused, and antagonism to the religious sanctions of the moral law, both come from the same source. over the fountain of revolutionism and anti-Christian belief, place the descriptive and definitive term Jewish, and let the sons of the Anglo-Saxons learn from what waters they were drinking. That source is not Mosaic, but Jewish. There is a world of difference between them. The central groups of red philosophers in every state universe or in every university is a Jewish group, with often enough a Gentile front in the shape of a deluded professor. Some of these professors are in the pay of outside red organizations. There are intercollegiate socialist societies swarming with Jews and Jewish influences, and toting Jewish professors around the country, addressing medics in Litz and even the divinity schools under the patronage of the best civic and university auspices. Student lecture courses are fine pasture for this propaganda. Intercollegiate liberal leagues are established everywhere, the purpose evidently being to give students the thrill of believing what they are taking part in is the beginning of a great new movement, comparable to the winning of independence or the abolition of slavery. And updated today, that would be civil rights, and they go to all these fag things. Like I've said before, they had standing room only at Truman State for the mother of the dead queer cruiser, Matt Shepard, because all the little sucker kids from Flyover, and these are the higher IQ ones because it's one of the better public liberal arts colleges in the Midwest, all think they're getting on board the next train for civil rights, and they don't want to miss it. They want to be part of the thrill. So when he says the thrill of believing they are taking part in a great new movement, yes, that's exactly what they think, mistakenly. As Stein parties gradually cease as college diversion, red conferences will come in. It is part of the effervescence of youth. Effervescence means bubbliness. The revolutionary forces which head up in Jewry rely very heavily on the respectability which is given their movement by the adhesion of students and a few professors. It was so in Russia. Everyone knows what the name student eventually came to signify in that country. And as a result, while Sovietists are glorifying the success, quote-unquote, of the revolution, men like Maxim Gorky are sending out appeals for food to prevent the intelligentsia from starving to death. The Jewish Chautauqua, again, that's the sort of tent revival, learning, entertainment, it's all kind of a big mix that took place in Chautauqua, New York, or upstate New York, and spread all over the a lot of the country in the 1800s. The Jewish Chautauqua, which works exclusively in colleges and universities, together with Bolshevism in art, science, religion, economics, and sociology, are driving straight through the Anglo-Saxon traditions and landmarks of our races of students. And these are ably assisted by professors and clergymen whose thinking has been dislocated and poisoned by Jewish subversive influences in theology and sociology. What to do about it? Simply identify the source and nature of the influence which has overrun our colleges. Let the students know that their choice is between the Anglo-Saxons and the tribe of Judah. Let the students decide, in making up their allegiance, whether they will follow the builders or those who seek to tear down. It is not a case for argument. Radicalism and religious indifferentism are states of mind. Normal men usually grow out of them in good time. Others are caught and held to the end, but the treatment is not argument. The only antidote to the Jewish influence is to call college students back to a pride of race. We often speak of the fathers as if they were the few who happened to affix their signatures to a great document which marked a new era of liberty. The fathers were the men of the Anglo-Saxon Celtic race, hyphenated all that, the men who came across Europe with civilization in their blood and in their destiny, the men who crossed the Atlantic and set up civilization on a bleak and rock-bound coast, the men who drove west to California and north to Alaska, the men who peopled Australia and seized the gates of the world at Suez, Gibraltar, and Panama, the men who opened the tropics and subdued the Arctics, Anglo-Saxon men, who have given form to every government and a livelihood to every people and an ideal to every century. They got neither their God nor their religion from Judah, nor yet their speech nor their creative genius. They are the ruling people, chosen throughout the centuries to master the world by building it ever better and better, and not by breaking it down. Into the camp of this race, among the sons of the rulers, comes a people that has no civilization to point to, no aspiring religion, no universal speech, no great achievement in any realm but the realm of Get, cast out of every land that gave them hospitality, and these people endeavor to tell the sons of the Saxons what is needed to make the world what it ought to be. He's emphasizing the impudence of this, the chutzpah, the brazen lying. If our sons in college follow this counsel of dark rebellion and destruction, it is because they do not know whose sons they are, of what race they are the scions. Let there be free speech to the limit in our universities and free intercourse of ideas, but let Jewish thought be labeled Jewish, and let our sons know the racial secret. The warning has already gone out through the colleges. The system of procedure is already fully known, and how simple it is. First, you secularize the public schools. Secularize is the precise word the Jews use for the process. You prepare the mind of the public school child by enforcing the rule that no mention shall ever be made to indicate that culture or patriotism is in any way connected with the deeper principles of the Anglo-Saxon religion. Keep it out, every sight and sound of it. Keep out also every word that will aid any child to identify the Jewish race. Then, when you have thus prepared the soil, you can go into the universities and colleges and enter upon the double program of pouring contempt on all the Christian landmarks and at the same time filling the void with Jewish revolutionary ideas. The influence of the common people is driven out of the public schools, where common people's influence can go, but Jewish influence is allowed to run rampant in the higher institutions where the common people's influence cannot go. Secularize the public schools, and you can then Judaize the universities. This is the liberalism, in quotes, which Jewish spokesmen so much applaud. In labor unions, in church, in university, it has tinctured the principles of work, faith, and society. This will not be denied, because the proof of it is too thickly written over Jewish activities and utterances. Indeed, it is in exerting these very influences that Jewry convinces itself it is fulfilling its mission to the world. The capitalism attacked is non-Jewish capitalism. The orthodoxy attacked is Christian orthodoxy. The society attacked is the Anglo-Saxon form of society, all of which, by their destruction, would redound to the glory of Judaism. The list could be extended. The influence of the Jewish idea on Anglo-Saxon sports and pleasure, on the Anglo-Saxon Celtic idea of patriotism, on the Anglo-Saxon Celtic conception of the learned professions. The influence of the Jewish idea runs down through every department of life. Well, one very badly deluded Anglo-Saxon editor, wrapped up in Jewish advertising contracts, was heard to say, "If the Jews can get away with it, then they have a right to." It is a variant of the answer of Jewish origin, which runs thus, "How can a paltry 3 million run the 100 million of the rest of us?" Nonsense. Yes, let it be agreed. If the Jewish idea is the stronger, if the Jewish ability is greater, let them conquer. Let Anglo-Saxon principles and Anglo-Saxon power go down in ruins before the tribe of Judah. But first let the two ideas struggle under their own banners. Let it be a fair struggle. It is not a fair fight when in the movies, in the public schools, in the Judaized churches, in the universities, the Anglo-Saxon idea is kept away from Anglo-Saxons on the plea that it is sectarian or clannish or obsolete or something else. It is not a fair fight when Jewish ideas are offered as Anglo-Saxon ideas because offered under Anglo-Saxon auspices. Let the heritage of our Anglo-Saxon Celtic fathers have free course among their Anglo-Saxon Celtic sons, and the Jewish idea can never triumph over it. In university form or in the marts of trade? The Jewish idea never triumphs until first the people over whom it triumphs are denied the nurture of their native culture. Judah has begun the struggle. Judah has made the invasion. Let it come. Let no man fear it. But let every man insist that the fight be fair. Let college students and leaders of thought know that the objective is the regnancy of the ideas and the race that have built all the civilization we see, and that promise all the civilization of the future. Let them also know that the attacking force is Jewish. That is all that will be necessary. And it is against this that the Jews protest. You must not identify us, they say, quote, you must not use the term Jew. Why? Because unless the Jewish idea can creep in under the assumption of other than Jewish origin, it is doomed. Anglo-Saxon ideas dare proclaim themselves and their origin. A proper proclamation is all that is necessary today. Compel every invading idea to run up its flag. And that's the end of 65. Talking about the Jewish idea invading every aspect of life, but focusing on it in the schools, in the churches, and in the labor movement, but pointing out that it could be discussed in sports and everywhere else. And the Jews dare not proceed under their own name, or they'll be rejected. And that was from May of 1921. And now let's quickly move on to the next, because it's related. The Jews' complaint against Americanism. Americanism in quotes. From the earliest record of the Jews' contact with other nations, no long period of years has ever passed without the charge arising that the Jews constitute, quote, a people within a people, a nation within a nation. When this charge is made today, it is vehemently denied by men who pose as the defenders of their people, and the denial is more or less countenanced by all the Jews of every class. And yet there is nothing more clearly stated in Jewish teaching, nor more clearly indicated in Jewish life, than that the charge is true. But whether the truth should be used against the Jews is quite another question. If the Jews are a nation, their nationality founded upon the double ground of race and religion, it is certainly outside the bounds of reason that they should be asked or expected to de-racialize, denationalize, and de-religionize themselves, but neither is it to be expected that they should bitterly denounce those who state the facts. It is only upon a basis of facts that a solution of any problem can come. Where blame attaches is here, that the evident facts are denied, as if no one but the Jews themselves knew that there are such facts. If the Jews are to be continuously a nation, as they teach, and if the condition of, quote, a nation within a nation, unquote, becomes more and more intolerable, then the solution must come through one of two things: a separation of the nation from the rest of the nations, or an exaltation of the nation above the rest of the nations. There is a mass of evidence in Jewish writings that the leaders expect both of these conditions to come, a separate nation and a supernation. Indeed, the heart of Jewish teaching is, as quite fully illustrated in the last article, that Jewry is a separate nation now, and on the way to becoming a supernation. It is only those appointed to address the Gentiles who deny this. The real rabbinate of Israel does not deny. Now, in any investigation of the Jewish question, the student is struck over and over again by the fact that what the Jews most complain of, they themselves began. They complain of what they call anti-Semitism, but it must be apparent to the dullest mind that there never could have been such a thing as anti-Semitism were there not first such a thing as Semitism. And then take the complaint about the Jews having to live in ghettos. The ghetto is a Jewish invention. In the beginning of the invasion of European and American cities, the Jews always lived by themselves because they wanted to, because they believed the presence of Gentiles contaminated them. Jewish writers, writing for Jews, freely admit this, but in writing for Gentiles, they refer to the ghetto as a surviving illustration of Gentile cruelty. The idea of contamination originated with the Jews. It is spread by suggestion to the Gentiles. And you'll see that argued against. I argue against that all the time on Twitter. People telling me that, well, the church protected white people. It forced the Jews into the ghetto. That worked for thousands of years. Like, no. The Jews themselves went into the ghettos. It's just atrocity. It's a lighter version of their atrocity propaganda that they were persecuted by being herded and forced into ghettos. But the Christians are incapable of argument. They're incapable of recognizing historical fact. They repeat anything that they think sounds good. They defend the church for emotional reasons. And so with this fact of the separate nation, it was the Jews who first recognized it, first insisted upon it, and have always sought to realize that separatedness, both in thought and action, dare we say apartheid? Nay, more, the true and normal type of Jew today believes that the influence of Americanism, or of any civilized Gentile state, is harmful to Judaism. That is a serious statement, and no amount of Gentile assertion will be sufficient to confirm it. Indeed, it is such a statement as the Gentile of mind could not have evolved, because the trend of Gentile feeling is all in the opposite direction, namely that Americanization is a good thing for the Jew. It is from authoritative Jewish sources that we learn this fact, that what we call civilizing influences are looked upon as being at enmity with Judaism. It is not the Gentile who says that the Jewish ideals, as ideals, are incompatible with life in our country. It is the Jew who says so. It is he who inveighs against Americanism, not the American who inveighs against Judaism. As this article is one with the last, the same method of impassive presentation of the testimony will be followed. Readers of this study of the Jewish question should know that neither rhetoric nor emotion will contribute a single element to the solution of the question. We prefer to leave rhetoric and emotion to the anti-Semites who call names, and to the pro-Semites who are apparently reduced to the same necessitous level. Now, the first thing to know is this, that though Americanism is yet unfinished, Judaism has been complete for centuries. It basically was codified or sort of coagulated in the 500, 600, 400 AD, let's say. That's what they usually say, the Babylonian Talmud. And while no American would think of pointing to any part of the country or any group as representing the true and final type of Americanism, the Jews quite unhesitatingly point to parts of the world and to certain groups as representing the true type of Judaism. Where is the type to be found which Jewish writers recognize as the true one? Why, the Jew of the ghetto is held up in Jewish treatises as the norm of Judaism. The visitor in New York has perhaps seen on Central Park West the massive synagogue of the Spanish and Portuguese Jews. Its famous rabbi was the Reverend Dr. D. de Sola Poole. He is the author of the following words. Quote, "In the ghetto, the observance of Judaism was natural and almost inevitable. The regimen of Jewish life was the atmosphere that was breathed. Not only did public opinion make it possible for men to go bearded, to keep the head covered at all times, to carry the palm branch in the public street, or to walk the street in stocking feet on fast days, but public opinion made it almost impossible for a Jew to profane the Sabbath or the Passover regulations, or openly to transgress any of the main observances." And as we shall later see, the learned rabbi considers these conditions more preservative of Judaism than our American conditions. Reverend Dr. M. H. Segal expresses the view that Jewry in the more modern portions of Europe and America was really kept alive by the infusions of immigrants from Poland and Lithuania, where the mass bulk of Jews were in worse physical conditions, shtetls and ghettos of Poland and Eastern Europe. Asserting, in agreement with other Jewish leaders, that the Jewish center of the world has been until now in Russia and Poland, Dr. Segal says, "The war has destroyed the last traces of the declining Jewish society, which has dragged out its feeble existence in the semi-medieval ghettos of Poland and Lithuania. With all their growing feebleness, these communities were yet the last refuge of Judaism in the dispersion." That'd be the diaspora today, he would have said. "In them there had still survived something of the old Jewish life, some of the old Jewish institutions, practices, and traditions. These communities also supplied such vitality as they could afford to the attenuated and atrophied Judaism in the communities of the more modern states of Europe and America." End of the block quote. The idea is not at all uncommon that large infusions of real Jews from the old world ghettos are necessary and desirable in order to keep Judaism alive in countries like the United States. Israel Friedlander, whose name just at present is held in peculiar honor by the Jews, and justly so, was a man of most enlightened intellect, and he too recognized the service of the ghetto stream to Judaism. In his lecture, "The Problem of Judaism in America," he speaks about the de-Judaizing tendency of absolute freedom, such as the Jew has always enjoyed in the United States. This tendency, he says, is corrected in two ways. by anti-Semitic influences, and, quote, by the large stream of Jewish emigration, on the other hand, which, proceeding from the lands of oppression to the lands of freedom, carries with it, on or under the surface, the preserving and reviving influences of the ghetto, unquote. The same authority, in an article entitled The Americanization of the Jewish Immigrant, frankly prefers the Jew fresh from the ghetto to the Jew who has been influenced by American life. He says that he, quote, prefers the caftan-clad, old-fashioned Jew with the unattractive appearance and ungainly manners, whose whole life is dominated by the ideals and mandates of an ancient religion and civilization, to that modernized, amphibious creature, the gaudily attired, slang-using, gum-chewing, movie-visiting, dollar-hunting, vulgar and uncultured, quasi-Americanized gentleman, spelled D-Z. Is an attempted pronunciation. The caftan-clad, old-fashioned Jew, of whom Mr. Friedlander writes, is the Polish Jew, 250,000 of whom are coming to the United States as, quote, a preserving and reviving influence upon Judaism in the United States. Not to use more space, however, on the identity of the normal type of Jew, as precisely stated by those who have expressed themselves on the subject, it is possible to preserve the idea and add its logical complement by quoting some testimony in the Jewish view of Americanization. What now follows is of special interest because it is so generally stated and received throughout Jewish circles that the center of Jewry has shifted to America. That is the form in which Jewish spokesmen make the statement. They say America, not the United States. A little story, a true one, may be worthwhile here. It may throw a sidelight on the use of the word American, as used in the testimony. A certain editor of an American newspaper gave a trifling bit of publicity to this series of articles that Dearborn Independent were talking from. Jewish advertising was withdrawn from his columns by the chairman of the Anti-Defamation Committee of the local lodge of B'nai B'rith, which chairman was also an advertising agent who handled all the Jewish advertising in that city. The editor, not being a wise man, yielded to the bulldozing methods used upon him, and in a half-hearted bit of editorial praise for the Jews, used the word Americanism. The advertising agent toyed with the word in the manner of one who, having a weak Gentile in his power, would make the best of it. "Why did you say Americanism? Why did you not say civilization?" he asked. The editor to this day thinks it was a bit of captiousness. It was not. There is meaning in it. To Americanize means, in our ordinary speech, to bring into sympathy with the traditions and institutions of the United States. But the Jews do not mean only the United States when they say America. They mean also South and Central America, where so many revolutions have occurred. There are large numbers of Jews in Argentina, and many are found in other countries. The next place to be extensively colonized will be Mexico. If the people of the United States see a Jewish ambassador sent to represent them in Mexico, they must know that the invasion of that country is about to begin. If the ambassador is not himself a Jew, it will be well to scrutinize his connections. There may be reasons which will make it necessary to employ a Gentile front for a time. Now, it would probably give a wrong twist to the fact to say that the Jewish leaders are anti-American, but it is true that they are against the Americanization of the Jewish immigrant stream. That is, the trend of Americanism is so different from the trend of Judaism that the two are in conflict. This does not indicate treason toward American nationalism, perhaps, so much as it indicates loyalty toward Jewish nationalism. But the reader must himself be the judge as to how far the difference goes. The testimony which will now be given divided itself into two parts. First, that relating to the American state in particular. Second, that relating to any Gentile state. After he had spoken in praise of the old type of Jew, as seen in the foreign ghettos, Dr. D. De Sola Poole, separate words, De Sola Poole, P-O-O-L, added, "To a large extent, the adult Jewish population of the United States has been reared in Jewish communities of this type of Jewish inevitableness. To a large extent, the young generation is being reared in an atmosphere in which this type of Jewishness is unknown, or at least strange and impossible. Jewish religious observance in the United States is becoming increasingly difficult and increasingly rare. Describing the antagonism between the American and the Jewish tendencies, he continues with this reference to the effect of Americanism, quote-unquote, on the Jewish modes of worship, colon. On the platform officiate a cantor and a preacher who turn their backs to the ark and address themselves to their congregation. The talith and similar externals are un-American and have consequently been sacrificed. The American worships with a bare head. Therefore, the American of Jewish persuasion must also doff his headgear when at worship. Hebrew, an Oriental language, is not an American tongue. The American prays in English, which all understand, and accordingly, the American of Jewish faith has anglicized his ritual. Such a ritual is not susceptible of being chanted with a traditional Jewish chazanuth. I probably pronounced that wrong, but chazanuth. And the music of the temple has therefore been brought up to date by the introduction of an organ, sacred music borrowed from non-Jewish neighbors, and mixed choirs in which non-Jewish singers are almost the rule. The Jewish Sabbath is out of keeping with the environment, and the only way in which it seemed to be possible to save it was by celebrating it with a Friday evening temple service after supper, and resting, and sometimes also attending temple on Sunday. It is not difficult to detect underneath these words the tone of criticism for such Americanization. It is a criticism which is fully justified by conditions, and it must be remembered that it was not uttered by a caftan-clad, old-fashioned Jew, but by a learned rabbi with a magnificent temple on Central Park West, a man whom our government has seen fit to honor. But that is not all that Dr. De La Sola Poole objects to, nor does he mince words in making his objections known. Quote, if so far reform has avoided the logical end of the process and has stopped short of identifying itself with Christianity, it has Americanized Judaism by dropping the elements that are characteristically Jewish and un-American, and has thereby created an almost non-sectarian Judaism housed in an almost non-sectarian temple. It will be noticed that the learned doctor uses the word American as one accustomed to quite another atmosphere. A fuller illustration or a further illustration is found in this, quote, neglect of the un-American dietary laws is usually the first step that the Americanizing Jew takes in asserting his Americanism. The, quote, un-American dietary laws, unquote, are, of course, the Jewish dietary laws, kosher, that is. But if any Gentile writer had so referred to them, he would have been abused as a hostile witness. It is very curious indeed to read the long list of complaints against modern conditions and their power to bring about the, quote, decay of Judaism, unquote. The ghetto, which makes for separateness, is frequently heralded as the true safeguard of Judaism. Intercourse with the world is dangerous. Americanizing influences are distrusted. No doubt many and many a Gentile parent in New York, Boston, Louisville, Dallas, and other American cities has witnessed the spectacle of Jewish teachers and, quote, welfare workers, unquote, instructing Gentile children in the principles of Americanism. But did anyone ever see a Gentile teacher instructing Jewish children in Americanism? Recently, when the American Legion asked permission of the government to establish Americanization classes at Ellis Island, where tens of thousands of Polish Jews gain entry into the U.S., the reply was a refusal, and the reason given was that all the space for charitable institutions was taken. What charitable institutions? How many of them were Jewish? Quote, the beginning of this decay, says Israel Friedlander, referring to the effect of modern life on Judaism, is obviously coincident with the beginning of Jewish emancipation, that is to say, with the moment when the Jews left the ghetto to join the life and culture of the nations around them. Unquote. Mr. Friedlander even went so far as to say that the pogroms against the Jews were, quote, fortunate, unquote, in that they drove the Jews back to their Judaism. Quote, fortunately, however, Russian Jewry was halted on its downward rush toward national self-annihilation. The process of assimilation was cut short by the pogroms, and ever since then the Jews of Russia have stood firmly their ground. Pogrom, of course, is the Jewish bias term or smear for resistance to Jew-inflicted communism on the locals. That may be the reason why some Jewish spokesmen of the Jews in America are trying to make this series of articles appear as a, quote, pogrom, unquote. So you even write an article telling the truth about the Jews, quoting Jewish sources, and they call it a pogrom. There is plenty of evidence to indicate that Jewish leaders have regarded pogroms, in modern times at least, as very useful in preserving the solidarity of Jewry. However, those who are responsible for the present series of articles, much as they hope to benefit the general situation of the humbler Jews by showing the use which the leading Jews are making of them, must decline to be counted among those who justify pogroms on any ground whatsoever. So we're just here to provide solid information to show the little Jews how the big Jews are using them. Justice Brandeis of the United States Supreme Court is also an exponent of the idea that, released from ghetto influences, the Jew becomes less of a Jew. He says, "We must protect America and ourselves from demoralization, which has to some extent already set in among American Jews. The cause of this demoralization is clear. It results, in large part, from the fact that in our land of liberty, all the restraints by which the Jews are protected in their ghettos were removed, and a new generation left without necessary moral and spiritual support." Justice Brandeis is a Zionist on these very grounds. He wants the land of Palestine because there the Jews, as he says, may live together and lead a Jewish life. Not the United States, but Palestine is Justice Brandeis's hope for the Jews. He says of Palestine that, quote, there only can Jewish life in Palestine be fully protected from the forces of disintegration. Arguing the same question, the Reverend Mr. S. Levy says, quote, "I shall probably be told that the reestablishment of Jews as a nation would mean the recreation of the ghetto, or the recreation of the ghetto. I am frankly prepared to admit the force of the criticism, but with an important qualification, dependent upon the interpretation of the word ghetto. Insofar as the National Center will ensure the existence of the Jewish environment, Jewish atmosphere, and Jewish culture, there will be a recreation of the ghetto." Will be italicized. The italics are Mr. Levy's. The continuance of Judaism, then, is dependent on the existence of an area with an aggregation of Jews living in a Jewish environment, breathing a Jewish atmosphere, and fostering a Jewish culture, and these factors must predominate over all other influences. It is therefore plain that, however startling and improbable the statement may seem when made by a Gentile, the Jews themselves regard the influences of modern lands as inimical to Judaism. But there is still a further consideration, which is distinctly set forth in Jewish writings, namely, that the trend of the modern state is harmful to all that Judaism holds to be essential to its moral and spiritual welfare. The modern state is changing, and Jewish observers sense the fact more readily than do the rest of the people, because Jews see in the change both an opportunity and a menace. If the state continues to change according to the trend of the general mind of the world, Jewish ideas of supremacy will find less and less opportunity to be realized. That is the menace. If the change or the spirit of change can be seized and twisted to Jewish purposes, as was done in Russia, and a Jewish type of state erected on the ruins of the old, that is the opportunity. Readers of these articles know that stimulation of the spirit of change is one of the clearest planks in the world program. As Cyril M. Picciotto, P-I-C-C-I-O-T-T-O, points out in his Conceptions of the State and the Jewish Question, there is a tendency to increase the control of the state over the individual. This, of course, has nowhere been done so thoroughly as in Russia under the Jewish Bolshevik regime, but it is not of this that Mr. Picciotto speaks. It is of the tendency observed in the Gentile states, and he asks, in the face of such a tendency in political development, which it is not rash to assume will be more pronounced in the future than in the past, how does the Jew stand as the state, as they go from classical liberalism to therapeutic managerialism in the welfare state? How does that affect the Jews? Is it good for Jews? He adds, The time is not far distant when the development of the state will continue on organic and collectivist lines. The central authority will embrace an ever wider idea, will make such a penetration into the recesses of individual freedom as would have been thought inconceivable 30 or 40 years ago. Well, he's proved right about that. Compulsory military service, compulsory education, compulsory insurance are but milestones on the road which logically leads to the adoption of a state morality, a state creed, and a common way of life. To say this is merely to indicate the probable trend, not to approve it. So how do they work that? Well, they get in charge of it, and then they're the ones making sure that the official creed is their own, which for them is racism, Nazism, collectivism, and racialism, and for us is diversity and white genocide and the rest, although it's obviously not called white genocide. He adds, the time is not... Well, that's the paragraph I just read. To say this is merely to indicate the probable trend, not to approve of it. How, then, is the state of the future going to deal with the people in its midst, which largely preserves its separateness of blood, which in its fasts, its day of rest, its dietary laws, its marriage ceremony suggest a distinct historic entity? The question is a disturbing one to Jews, as is shown by Rabbi Segal's words in, quote, The Future of Judaism. He even says that, quote, the medieval state, with all its tyranny and obscurantism, was more favorable to the Jews than the modern type of state. Its defective organization permitted both individuals and whole classes to live their life in their own way. Hence, the medieval state enabled the Jews to organize themselves on semi-national lines and, as far as circumstances permitted, to create afresh in their dispersion the national institutions and practices of their ancient commonwealth. Back then, the state wasn't a totalizing thing. It didn't try to handle as much as it does today. So there was room for intermediate institutions like the family and the church. Everything wasn't forced into a one-size-fits-all bureaucracy like we see today, where you can't even refuse to bake a cake for sex deviants or you're fined $136,000, as happened to a white Christian couple up in Oregon. They had, I believe, I don't know if they had the money to pay it, but they had all their three bank accounts seized, is what I read. Back to the thing. They did this, of course, by establishing the ghetto. They were allowed to do that in the Middle Ages. But this has become an absolute impossibility in the modern state, continues the rabbi. The rise of democracy and the transference of the ultimate power of government from the oligarchy to the majority involves the practical suppression of weak minorities. The identification of the state with the culture and aspiration of a particular nationality leads inevitably to the crippling of and gradual extinction of those classes who do not share that particular culture and those aspirations. The state, moreover, enforces a system of education which is purposely designed to fashion and mold all the inhabitants. It also maintains a thoroughgoing organization which embraces all the departments of the public and private life of all its inhabitants, irrespective of class, race, or tradition. Thus, there is no room, thus, in the modern state for Jewish culture, for Jewish national life, or for a specifically Jewish society with its own specific institutions, customs, and practices. Therefore, Judaism can live and work only with a specifically Jewish society and within a Jewish national organization. The medieval ghetto, with all its narrowness, with all the unhealthy and abnormal conditions of its existence, yet contained such a semi-national society. Therefore, Judaism flourished in the medieval ghetto. The modern state, on the other hand, has broken up that specifically Jewish society. But the Jews, of course, adapted. Now, there are the reactions of leading Jewish minds to conditions in America particularly, and to conditions in the modern Gentile state generally. The statement of the antagonism which exists between the two is clear and complete. The Gentiles do not notice that antagonism, but the Jews are always and everywhere keenly aware of it. This throws a light, a very strong light, on all the revolutionary programs to break up the present control of society by sowing dissensions between capital and labor, so-called, by cheapening the dignity of government through corrupt politics, by trivializing the mind of the people through theaters and movies and similar agencies, and by weakening the appeal of a distinctively Christian religion. A breakdown of Gentile seriousness is the opportunity of the Jew, and that is more or less exactly what Frankfurt School said years later. A breakdown of Gentile seriousness is the opportunity of the Jew. A colossal war is also his opportunity, as witness his seizure of the United States government during the recent war. Judaism says that Americanism and Gentile nationalism generally are harmful to it. Judaism has therefore the alternative of changing and controlling Gentile nationalism, or of constructing a nationalism of its own in Palestine. It is trying both. This all harks back to what Lord Eustace Percy has quoted in the Jewish press as saying, that the Jew participates in revolutions not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is ever anything but distasteful to him. And the same author, another quote, quote, in a world of completely organized territorial sovereignties, he, the Jew, has only two possible cities of refuge. He must either pull down the pillars of the whole national state system, or he must create a territorial sovereignty of his own. In this, perhaps, lies the explanation of both Jewish Bolshevism and of Zionism, for at this moment Eastern Jewry seems to hover uncertainly between the two, and it came to that fork in the road and it took both of them. So it has Israel, and it's rapidly disintegrating the Goy nations. Isn't that wonderful? And this was published on 23rd of October 1920 in the Dearborn Independent. That's the conclusion of chapter 66. So the Jew sees various trends in the modern world, and they may be objectively anti-Jew, but yet he figures out ways to turn them to his advantage. Always trying to have everything his way, always insisting on special privileges, tearing down what's good for you and erecting what's good for him. Well, thanks for listening to me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.